Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Because he became a national name so early, basketball phenom LeBron James has transformed several times from a budding superstar whose high school games became ESPN events to a hometown hero with the Cleveland Cavaliers to an opportunistic free agent to Miami Heat pariah and playoff choker. LeBron was never able to win a championship in Cleveland, a city that aches for any type of sports success after decades of futility. But when he had a chance to stay in the city that begged him to do just that, LeBron had other plans.
What's your decision?
In this fall, man, this is very tough. In this fall, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach and join the Miami Heat.
The city was crushed, the Cavs owner defiant. For Esquire writer and Cleveland native Scott Rabb, who had once pulled LeBron aside to call him the greatest player he'd ever seen, this was an act of betrayal on a biblical scale. Rabb spent the following months chasing LeBron in the Heat, antagonizing what he saw as a traitorous, soulless talent, even as he dealt with his own health and mental issues. The result is a book called The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James, which is now out in paperback from Harper. Scott Rabb, welcome to the Roundtable.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
A lot of the selfish behavior on the part of LeBron began when he was in Cleveland. So I'm wondering when, in your mind, he changed over from the guy you were rooting for and the city's hopes to the title of your book, The Whore of Akron.
It's an easy answer. July 8th, 2010, when he made the so-called decision to take his talents to South Beach. He was a jerk before that. I saw some of that when I began the book, because I began it hoping to write the happy book. I stayed with the Cavs. I was somewhat, you could say, embedded with the team, hoping to write a book about our hometown Moses, leading us all, that tribe of Clevelanders who've suffered for nearly half a century without any pro sports championship. He was going to lead us to the promised land. And even though there was more than a smidgen of jerkiness about his behavior, he was our guy. So really the worm turned that night when he went on ESPN and for an hour basically rubbed the city and the fan base's nose in garbage.
Do you think LeBron could have stayed in Cleveland under any circumstance? What I mean is, when did he decide that whenever he left, he was definitely going to leave? Had they won a championship, would he have stayed? When did he make that decision?
There are many people who feel that his now teammate Dwayne Wade, his now teammate Chris Bosh, who was playing for Toronto, that when they played on the Olympic team, back before they all signed contract extensions in 2007, they became pals on the Olympic team. They had made some kind of agreement, and it's no question that the three of them talked about joining forces. Whether LeBron made the decision or had it firmly in mind to leave Cleveland before he became a free agent on July 1st, 2010, only LeBron knows. I mean, the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, Dan Gilbert, has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to put together a collusion or tampering case to bring to the NBA without any success, to no avail. So you can imagine a scenario where if the Cavaliers had managed to win a championship during LeBron's tenure with the Cavaliers, where he would have stayed. I think I speak for a lot of Cleveland fans when I say, had they won a championship with LeBron and then LeBron decided to become a free agent, I don't think the same feelings of betrayal or the same vitriol would apply. That, of course, is not how it worked out.
You get the feeling with LeBron that, yes, he was from Ohio, but he was never really a fan the way you are a fan. He was out for himself from the moment it became clear that he was going to be an all-time talent.
And even as a youngster growing up in Akron, which, while it's certainly not a Cleveland suburb, is part of the northeastern Ohio fan base that cheers for the Cavaliers and the Cleveland Browns and the Cleveland Indians, LeBron, growing up, cheered for the New York Yankees, the Dallas Cowboys, and the Chicago Bulls. When LeBron had a decision to make about going to high school, he grew up in West Akron. There was a public school, Akron Bucktel, which was his local school and the school where all the African-American kids went. LeBron chose to go to St. Vincent, St. Mary, basically an all-white private school. And the feelings that are packed into The Whore of Akron, my book, very much mirror the way the community that LeBron grew up in felt about his decision not to go to Akron Bucktel, but to go to St. Vincent, St. Mary instead. So LeBron, from a very early age, was a phenom. and was very much sought after and very privileged. I mean, for a kid who really did come up hard, born to a woman who wasn't a woman yet, really, 15, 16-year-old mother, and LeBron was farmed out to different families when his mother, Gloria, couldn't quite keep body and soul together. At a certain point, LeBron became acclaimed beyond belief for a child of his age, and of course, we continue to see to this day. The fact that he did grow up in northeastern Ohio cheering for the teams that won, looking back, is kind of a preview of a certain kind of loyalty that meant nothing in terms of where he chose to ply his trade.
Let me take up the other side with you, if you don't mind. Okay, let's say it's not LeBron's fault necessarily that none of the Cleveland franchises have won in 48 years, I think, all combined. He would say, I have this free agency. I want to be on the beach in Miami. I want to go play with my friend Dwayne Wade. Why is the entire city's psyche my problem?
I think that's, first of all, perfectly valid point. I mean, you and I and anyone else has every right. We want to work where we want to work, where we feel it's best for us and our families. That's no problem. And for a young guy who didn't go to college and who only, spent his childhood in a place, was drafted by the local team, has the opportunity to explore the world, it's also not a problem. And so what you really have is the irrationality of being a fan, of being a diehard, of being someone who pours so much emotion into professional sports. And, to put the burden of not just five decades of sports failure, but a half century of a downward spiral, in a Rust Belt town, to put that on the shoulders of basically an adolescent. I mean, he came into the NBA at the age of 18, and to say, be our Moses, redeem us. I mean, on the face of it, that's absurd. And so I can't even defend it. It's one of the reasons that in writing the book, I don't think I could ever make a cogent, rational, connect-the-dots case for his villainy. All I can say is sports is one of those places where in certain towns, certainly in Cleveland, these myths and legends are passed on. They're a kind of legacy. It has nothing to do with rational thought. It has to do with, I was there then, and this represents all that we are, all that we ever were, and this is our hope for the future. And all that BS that people around the globe pour into sports, I think especially men, all those emotions, all that belligerence, all that false pride, it's really at the heart of being a fan, especially a Cleveland fan. Is that fair to any athlete, much less to a young guy like LeBron? It has nothing to do with fair.
How come, for you, Jewish identity and being a Cleveland fan seems so intertwined?
It's one of the things that I tried to unravel in writing the book, because as it became clear that I wasn't writing a happy book anymore, that LeBron wasn't the Cleveland Cavalier, that he wasn't going to lead us to a championship. There have been a series of hideous defeats during the course of my lifetime. I'm old enough to remember being at Cleveland Municipal Stadium when the Cleveland Browns won a championship in 1964. That was the last Cleveland championship. And for some reason, partly because I was living in my grandparents' house at the time, my folks had split up. It was an Orthodox Jewish household in a pretty Orthodox neighborhood in Cleveland Heights. These became the touchstones of my existence. These became inextricably entwined. And part of that was, I was born in 1952. The World War II and the Holocaust was pretty recent history. And so at that point, and I would argue and do argue, Jews still tend to define themselves as people who suffer. And while I certainly don't mean to compare the suffering of a Cleveland sports fan to the particular suffering of my tribe, of my ethnic tribe during those years, that whole mix of kind of chest beating, woe is us, and being a small band of survivors, that kind of mentality really did creep into me at a pretty early age. And as ludicrous as it sounds, and I don't think I take it at all seriously in the book, I take it seriously just in terms of my own identity. I am a Jew. I am a Clevelander by birth. I am a Cleveland fan. And this is part of what defines me, for better and worse.
Having read the book, I think if I had to describe the way your house sounded, it's like radio days without any of the laughs.
I love that movie. That's a really cruelly underrated Woody Allen movie. It was a very, you know, anyone who thinks that the Protocols of the Elders of Zion or any other of the anti-Semitic trash lore that go, anyone who thinks that all Jews are this or all Jews are that really has no knowledge whatsoever of how many people, how many immigrants, which my grandparents were, struggled for a lifetime unsuccessfully. I mean, my grandfather was a railroad laborer. He washed railroad cars for the New York Central Railroad, and my grandmother was a bakery clerk for more than 40 years. And that household was really stressed, both economically and psychically, by that struggle. But you know, looking back, I can kvetch all I want, about the fighting, including physical fighting that went on there. But you could knock on any door and find far worse in terms of people's monstrosity to their children. But it also imbued me with a sense that there were no boundaries, there was no censorship. My father was thousands of miles away, and really no one was capable of controlling me at a point where I was really angry in general. And it was perfect training for a writer, it turns out.
I've covered a good bit of basketball, so this part of the book really fascinated me. The question of the role of media when the NBA and ESPN have clearly gotten into bed together and reporters are daring enough to question LeBron James to his face, and what that equation leads to for someone who is covering the game, and you were really shut out in many ways.
Yeah, I was unable to obtain credentials, the same credential that the NBA gives to hundreds of media members, including the guys who duct tape ESPN's cables to the floor. They refused to credential me. I've been writing for Esquire magazine since 1997, full-time. And while I've never been a sports writer per se, I've been writing about sports for national magazines literally for 25 years. They don't have a policy, really, about who to give credentials to or who to refuse. But you know, ultimately, they said it's up to the team, which put the Miami Heat in a very peculiar position because I am a Clevelander. I am a Cleveland fan. I have a tattoo of the Cleveland Indians logo on my arm. And while I didn't approach them to say, I'm here to write a hatchet job book about LeBron, I didn't try to finesse the situation either. So it wound up where they felt forced to credential me for a single game of LeBron's initial season with the Heat. But then I blogged something for Esquire.com, and then I made a couple of blunders on Twitter, but in general, you know, there was no, and there is no, real free and easy access to any athlete anymore in professional sports, much less someone of LeBron's stature and fame and controversy. When you look at ESPN, you see a monolith, really a media monolith, which does business, is a business partner, not just with the NBA, but with Major League Baseball, and with the National Football League, and with every major college conference. And they sell advertising time to the shoe manufacturers and the, you know, specialized water manufacturers, companies that pay tens of millions of dollars to the athletes on those teams. So what you really see in terms of sports journalism is just one seamless business where between Disney and Nike and the NBA, there really is no separation anymore, and it's very important for them to protect their brands, and those brands include players like LeBron James.
This book is as much really about your journey as it is LeBron's, and it's interesting to put them side by side. Basketball, by definition, a very young man's game. LeBron's in the NBA by 18. He's a father. You became a father, I think, at 47 years old. You spent a long interregnum learning how to be, in many ways, an adult writer and how to take care of yourself and that kind of thing. Do you think, had you guys maybe been able to trade mindsets for a while, that would have served LeBron to have the kind of life experience that he wasn't able to get, having always gone right into basketball?
Well, I think some of the same boundarylessness and lack of self-censorship I think that's something that I, by the end of the book, which I didn't plan to become this kind of personal journey type of book, I think I feel that in common with LeBron. I think one of LeBron's issues, and we'll see during this year's playoffs whether he's somehow resolved it, at least well enough to perform under pressure, is that he never had a strong male influence, whether it's a father, an older brother, a family friend, or an uncle, explaining to him that no matter how much talent you have, you're going to have to work and work and fail in order to finally succeed. It took me much longer to learn that than it could possibly take a pro athlete, because I was in my 40s when I realized, and you know, part of it is the clean and sober story. I mean, part of it is that aspect of a personal journey, and part of it is realizing as a writer that you're going to have to endure for a very long time before you can find any success. That's something that I came to understand to some degree during the writing of the book, and by the end of the book, I'm directly addressing LeBron, you know, as if he were my son, not just as if he were someone with whom I had these things in common, and not because I hate, people love that word, not because I hate LeBron, but because I did love LeBron when he was a Cleveland Cavalier and really did hope, as a Cleveland fan, really did hope that he would deliver on his promise.
How did Albany legend William Kennedy help you on that writer's journey you just mentioned?
When I graduated from Cleveland State University at the ancient age of 31 or 32, this is back in the early 80s, I went to graduate school at the University of Iowa, which has this fantastic and pretty well-known writing program, the Writers' Workshop, they call it. So they bring in writers. Sometimes they stay for a semester and teach, and sometimes they simply visit and maybe give a reading and attend a class or two. William Kennedy came to a literature class. I don't remember any reading, but here was a guy. I had read Ironweed a couple of times by then, and a couple of other of his Buffalo books, but Ironweed I considered a very great novel, and I think it was being taught in that class. One of my favorite novels of the 20th century, and something that is so rich and works on so many levels as literature and as a tribute to memory and a city, you know, a particular place, and also it turns out, now that I've read it a few more times, has a lot to do with sobriety and recovery. William Kennedy was so, I mean, people overuse the word humble, including in the first person, about how humbling it is to be selected for, blah, blah, blah. William Kennedy embodied, he didn't have to use the word, he embodied that humility, and when he talked about how many publishers had rejected Ironweed, and how many times he had rewritten the manuscript in order to make it better, not more commercial, but a better book. I mean, I took that forward with me. I didn't think about magazine writing per se as a career. I don't think I was thinking about career. I was thinking about craft and getting better as a writer. And it helped me just enormously, first, to understand how important rewriting is, and rewriting, and rewriting. I mean, as obsessive and compulsive as it may sound, I think that's at the heart of any craft, including basketball. It's muscle memory of the mind, whatever. However you want to use the metaphor, in practical terms, he was an exemplar of endurance and just the perseverance and willingness to go back and back and back and back to make something better. And on the other side of that, having achieved some measure of success as a writer with a career, working for a magazine, Esquire, with an almost 80-year heritage of literary excellence, it also taught me not to take that too seriously. Just because I'm in a Lincoln Town Car being driven into New York City, you know, for an interview or something like that, you still got to laugh at yourself. How the heck did you end up in the back seat of this town car? And how can I make this story or the next story sing a little more clearly and a little better? I'll always feel a psychic debt to William Kennedy in that regard.
We've been speaking with Scott Rabb. He's the author of The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James, which is now out in paperback from Harper. He's also a writer at large for Esquire. Scott, thank you so much for the time. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, mine as well, Ian. Please have me back someday.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.